Yes, sir. NRC is an independent federal agency with the mission to license and regulate the nation's civilian use of byproduct, source, and special nuclear materials to ensure the protection of public health and safety, promote the common defense and security, and protection of the environment. Earlier today, we held an open house with members of the public. That meeting was specifically designed to allow members of the community to meet individually with NRC staff members. Tonight's meeting is designed to provide the community an opportunity to engage in an open public dialogue with the NRC and discuss views, information, concerns, and issues related to the Diablo Canyon Power Plant. My name is Vince Gaddy, and I'm the branch chief responsible for overseeing implementation of the NRC's safety inspection program at the Diablo Canyon Power Plant. With me tonight are Tony Vagel, Michael Peck, Tony Brown, Annie Kammerer, and Blair Spitzberg. Tony Vagel is the deputy director of the Division of Reactor Projects in our Region 4 office in Arlington, Texas. Michael and Tony Brown are resident inspectors assigned to the Diablo Canyon Power Plant. The resident inspectors work at Diablo Canyon on a full-time basis and provide the important function of providing daily oversight of safety issues. Annie Kammerer is a senior seismologist in the structural, geotechnical, and seismic engineering branch in our Office of Research. Blair is a branch chief in the repository and spent fuel branch of the Division of Nuclear Material Safety. And this branch provides regulatory oversight over many of the independent spent fuel storage installation activities. And in the audience are several other members of the NRC staff, most of which you met earlier during our earlier open house. I also want to acknowledge we have several members of the Mothers for Peace. We also heard that members of the San Luis Obispo County Board of Supervisors may also be present, representatives from U.S. congressional offices, as well as state and local officials. Before I begin tonight's discussion, I'd like to talk to you briefly about our goals, our annual assessment of the Diablo Canyon Power Plant, and our future inspection plans. All the activities that the agency conduct at the power plant are in the plant remains safe. With this slide, I wanted to convey how the NRC assessed performance at Diablo Canyon last year. Diablo Canyon met the high standards that we had established for operating reactors. In 2008, there were no safety significant issues at the plant, and all the issues identified were of very low safety significance. With respect to findings, the NRC assigns a color based on the significance of the findings, and those colors range from green, which are very low safety issues, to red, which are issues of high safety significance. But all of the findings in 2008 at Diablo Canyon were green, meaning they were of very low safety significance. This slide is intended to provide you with a little perspective as to how much time we actually spent performing direct inspection at Diablo Canyon last year. We spent approximately 2,500 hours of direct inspection hours on site last year. This included work by the resident inspectors who performed daily walkthroughs throughout the plant, as well as technical experts. And this included inspections such as the steam generator replacement activities. Plans for this year, we intend to conduct the same level of aggressive inspection at Diablo Canyon this year as we did last year. We're going to be focusing, we have already focused on steam generator replacement. That's already taken place, and the licensee will be replacing the reactor vessel head coming up in the fall. And we intend to spend several hundred hours of inspections following up on that activity. We also intend to conduct a very intrusive inspection of the fire protection program later on this year. And also, we plan, well, we already have, and we plan to continue to inspect a lot of more in-depth inspections following up on the independent spent fuel storage installation. Just kind of summarizing and looking forward, last year, the message that I wanted to leave with you, Diablo Canyon operated safely. There were no safety significant issues. All the findings were of very low safety significance. And we will continue to watch the plant closely this year, as we did last year, with the same level. Tonight's meeting is being videotaped by AGP Video and will be shown on your local channels, as we have done in previous meetings. In addition, the NRC has provided feedback forms at the entrance to this meeting room. The NRC highly values your input, and we request that you complete a feedback form and send them in or provide them to an NRC staff member before you leave. As you are aware, we have made changes to this meeting format based on comments we received from you in the past. Also, a meeting summary will be provided within 10 days. Included in that summary will be the attendance list that is available at the entrance to this room. If you haven't signed that attendance list, we would appreciate it if you do so before you leave. Also at the table outside are various brochures that describe the NRC mission and what we do on a daily basis. This meeting will conclude no later than 9 p.m. The NRC staff will be available following the meeting if anyone has additional questions or comments. As you all are aware, PG&E has notified the NRC of their intent to begin loading fuel into the independent spent fuel storage installation soon. At this time, Blair Spitzberg will be providing a few comments on the ISFSI project.
Thank you, Vincent. Again, my name is Blair Spitzberg, and this is not my first time here. I've been out here many times before in this very room, and I always enjoy coming to your community. I've also had members of my staff out here quite often in recent months as we have been performing inspections of the independent spent fuel storage installation in anticipation of operations in the near future. As you know, the NRC issued a license to PG&E to build an independent spent fuel storage installation, which is also called an ISFSI. I normally don't like acronyms, but we may, by accident, throw the word ISFSI at you tonight, and if we do, that is what it means. The license was issued in 2004 following a thorough and independent analysis of the proposed design. The organization Mothers for Peace subsequently sued the NRC in the U.S. Court of Appeals, maintaining that the agency had not considered the potential consequences of a terrorist attack on the ISFSI. The court ordered the NRC to prepare an analysis, and the agency did this in 2007. The Mothers for Peace subsequently filed an appeal with the commission, maintaining the analysis prepared by the NRC staff was inadequate. Moreover, underground storage systems have not been approved by the NRC for use in high seismic zones like Diablo Canyon. The casks, which are robust, massive concrete and steel structures weighing 170 tons when fully loaded, will be bolted to concrete pads that are 7.5 feet thick to provide seismic protection. The ISFSI also has security systems to protect against unauthorized access, another reason for clustering the cask in a central location rather than scattering them across the site. The NRC conducted several classified studies evaluating the robustness of spent fuel to a variety of land and air-based attacks. The possibility of a successful terrorist attack on an ISFSI is extremely low. It is highly unlikely that a significant release of radioactivity would occur, even in the unlikely event that such an attack by land, sea, or air was successful in rupturing a cask. Overall, the risk posed by the ISFSI is inconsequential compared to the risk of the reactor's operation. In the coming weeks, PG&E plans to begin transferring used fuel from Diablo Canyon spent fuel pools into casks for storage. When this occurs, it will be done under the watchful eyes of the NRC and my staff. Our inspectors will be on hand to ensure that the casks are loaded in compliance with our stringent safety regulations and will prepare a report documenting their findings that will be publicly available. In addition, from this point forward, our inspectors will routinely monitor activities associated with the spent fuel storage installation.
Thanks, Blair. At this time, I'd like to allow Chuck Castell the opportunity to provide a few opening comments. Chuck is the Deputy Regional Administrator in our Region 4 office in Arlington, Texas. And following Chuck, our moderator for tonight, Tony Brown, will discuss the guidelines for conducting tonight's meeting, and we will then proceed directly into questions and comments from the audience. Go ahead, Chuck.
Thank you, Vic. Vince. Good evening. Hi, folks. How you doing? We've been a little stiff so far, but we'll warm up to it. You know, we really appreciate y'all being here. This is actually, Blair has been here many times. This is actually my first visit, and I can tell you, I'm impressed by the public interest that you have in Diablo Canyon. We don't get this level of public interest at every site, and we really appreciate the opportunity to share with you what we know and what our evaluation is. You can see the importance that we play with a four-hour meeting, 2 hours before, 2 hours now, and we've listened to your input about how the meeting should be structured. So we really do value if you have other suggestions on how to run the meeting. We would appreciate that greatly. And Vince talked about the number of green findings there are at the site, the number of green findings, and then our license response column. I would just say that we continue to pursue a lot of issues, a wide range of issues at Diablo Canyon. We continue to pursue those. And we're a regulator that values a continuous oversight. We continually listen to people. We get input from many different sources about concerns or problems that there might be, and we listen to those, and we pursue each and every one of them to a resolution. Sometimes we may not be as quick as we'd like to be, but we pursue each and every one of them to its resolution. So we value the public input. And we have processes you can report, you can share with us concerns. As we get insights from everyone, we try to take that into our assessment process and resolve each and every one of those concerns. We're kind of an unsatisfied regulator. We always are looking for something to pursue. We have a lot of really smart technical people, and they love the challenge of a pursuit of a technical problem. So we enjoy that, and our process is perpetual. Diablo Canyon is being operated safely. It doesn't mean there are not issues that we need to pursue, and we're doing that. And we'll share with you if you have concerns about a particular area. Hopefully we've brought the right talent here tonight to answer those questions, and if not, we'll get you an answer. So with that, I appreciate it. It really is inspiring to see the number of people here that have interest in the safety of the operation of Diablo Canyon. So thank you, Tony.
Thanks, Chuck. Good evening. My name is Tony Brown. I'm the resident inspector here at Diablo Canyon. I'd like to welcome all of you here tonight to this meeting. Our goal here is to entertain questions regarding the performance of the Diablo Canyon power plant and any other issues of concern that you may have. As moderator, my responsibility is to ensure that the information that's presented from the NRC is clear and responsive, and to also ensure that everyone who wants an opportunity to speak tonight has that opportunity. And with respect to the ground rules, if you would like to speak, please just signal me. I'll come to you and bring the microphone. I'll hold on to the microphone. I ask that you keep your comments and questions to 3 to 5 minutes. This will support our goal of allowing as many people as possible to participate. 9677. Once again, his phone number is 1-800-952-9677. His email is victor.drix@nrc.gov. With that, let's begin the discussion.
My name is Chuck Lewis. I'm a senior nuclear advising engineer in the DCPP Quality Verification Department. I have 31 years experience in auditing of commercial nuclear power plants. And the last 20 years, I've been at DCPP, responsible for auditing the DCPP engineering organization. During the period between 1995 and 2007, Quality Verification Audit Program was held in high regard by the NRC, INPO, and others in the industry. In August 2007, one of the most experienced, knowledgeable, and respected QV leaders in the industry was replaced with a new director with no experience in quality assurance. Approximately a year later, that individual was replaced by the current QV director. During the period between August 2007 and June 2008, I personally saw vast auditing experience being lost through retirements, layoffs, and individuals leaving the company. A real-time observation was instituted, and observation of DCPP's compliance with industrial safety standards were provided. However, the observation program neglected to also focus on areas important to nuclear safety. In this period, the technical audit program was eliminated. In June 2008, the NIAP audit team concluded that the QB department infrastructure and experience has deteriorated from the loss of experienced personnel and from leadership changes, resulting in unfulfilled regulatory commitments and loss of capability to achieve and conduct key activities. The capability to independently verify the effectiveness of quality assurance programs is significantly diminished. In December 2008, the NRC PINR, the Problem Identification Resolution Inspection Report, documented that in the 18 months prior to the inspection, QV lost 10 experienced employees. In addition, there were two changes in the department directorship over the same period. The teams determined that these personnel losses and management changes resulted in insufficient resources to complete all tasks in a high-quality manner. In my opinion, some progress has been made and continues to be made. Ultimately, has resulted in better tools for our inexperienced auditors. The real-time observation program is starting to produce observations in the area of plant configuration, plant operations, in other words, areas important to safety. And the technical audit program has been reestablished. However, QV has a long ways to go before they regained a level of intrusiveness and effectiveness they had in the pre-2007 timeframe. To help ensure that the QV audit program regains an appropriate level of audit capability, I would like to respectfully request that the NRC, in particular, Senior Resident Inspector, consider taking one or more of the following actions. One, become familiar with the corrective action reports issued in 2008 that address problems with the QV audit program. Gain an understanding of the causes and the corrective actions that have been established. Two, add the QV audit program as an area of focus during the next NRC inspection period. And three, during the next PINR inspection, perform an in-depth review of the quality verification audit program effectiveness. Thank you.
Hi, thank you very much for your comments. My name is Michael Peck. I'm the senior resident inspector. I'm the senior resident inspector out at the Obel site, and I agree with most of your comments. I've had long discussions with the quality verification director and discussions on how the effectiveness of the organization can improve. In our inspection program, we don't directly assess the effectiveness of quality verification, with the exception of the PINR inspection program, which you've already addressed and we did comment on. But indirectly, we do try to draw conclusions as to the effectiveness of the program by making an indirect comparison with the findings and issues that the quality verification program identifies in comparison to the issues that we identify as part of our independent inspection program. So as we've go forward, we've had a lot of discussions with the QV manager, and we ask about how he's affecting change within the independent assessment program of QV. I have looked at the assessments that you mentioned, the one from last year, and the particular findings that were identified that addressed qualification issues, as well as actually missing some specific objectives requirements.
Thank you. My name is Paul Allen. About 2.5 years ago, I retired after 29 years of service with the local county air pollution control district, where I was a division manager with a staff of 3 or 4 who did air monitoring around the county and provided computer services for the district. I had the opportunity to work 22 years as an emergency response staffer in PG&E drills and training at the EOF by the Sheriff's Department. and over those years had the pleasure of working with some marvelous meteorologists. Most of those years as an emergency respondent, I was serving as a meteorologist in the UDAC, Unified Dose Assessment Center at the EOF. The PG&E meteorologists did some superb studies of airflow in the county in the early years of Diablo Canyon's operation and began building a custom dispersion model to identify where, in the event of an accident, some plume would go in the county. That was a huge project. They did tracer studies, brought in folks from Idaho to do sophisticated work. They began building this model, and it was unfortunately taking a bit too much time, so somebody chose to buy an off-the-shelf model that is currently in use now, MIDAS. And MIDAS works fine. It does a good job of dealing with the changes in nuclear species over time and deposition and such. Unfortunately, the model of MIDAS that PG&E chose is a single meteorology input point, and that is very insufficient for defining where air goes in the complex terrain inland in the county and with the marine land interface. There are just lots of complexities. The PG&E meteorologists who did those early studies had established a network of inland monitoring stations that would provide data for their model, and PG&E could have opted to buy a multi-input model of MIDAS. Instead, they chose the one-input model. We commented over, 15, 20 years, saying this doesn't work, this isn't adequate. PG&E themselves, the meteorologists, had identified that the version of MIDAS in use was not adequate and didn't do an accurate job of portraying where an impact would happen. Now that I've retired, I can speak more openly than I could when I was serving on staff. I didn't want my I have other copies of that that I can make available to you if you would like. It provides a number of attachments, which are reports from PG&E staff identifying the shortcomings of MIDAS. And I'm making this pitch to this meeting in the hopes that somehow change will happen and we'll get a proper meteorological dispersion model for San Luis County and for PG&E. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Allen, for the information. And my understanding is that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, as well as PNG, is taking action to address some of the issues. We'll take this back with us and review it thoroughly and get back with you as well. Thank you very much.
Yeah, hi, I'm Jim Becker. I'm the site vice president at Diablo Canyon. And regarding the issues that the last speaker brought up, he made some valid points. We have taken on a project at the station to look at upgrading our MIDAS system in what will turn out to be the best technological approach for our situation. We have funded it as a project. The project is underway. And I'd like to ask if it's okay, Mike Jin, our emergency planning manager, can give just a brief summary of what we're intending to do there.
No, I think that I think it's enough in okay. That that Mr. Allen understands some of the actions that have been taken, and there's been dialogue on that. And it's in the interest of giving everybody an opportunity to speak as well. Thank you, Mr. Becker.
Joan Carter from the Mothers for Peace. My latest, newest concern is the earthquake fault that was found 1 kilometer out from the plant. And with the history of undiscovered earthquake faults that Diablo has, it concerns me that this seems to have just been sort of drifting away and it's hidden up and nobody's really talking about it. And I don't understand how NRC could have overlooked this given that Diablo has been open for all these years and it's so close. So for them to call it an insignificant event, it seems really unusual to me that an earthquake fault that's newly discovered that has not really been evaluated is seen as insignificant. So I would like someone to talk to me about that.
Annie, would you respond to that, please?
Hi, my name is Annie Kammerer. I'm the senior seismologist in the Office of Research. It on the NRC website, it details specifically the independent assessment of the fault which was undertaken at the NRC as soon as we received preliminary information on this feature from the USGS and the PG&E Crater Group. So within the NRC, we've taken this new feature very, very seriously, this fault seriously, and immediately did an independent in-house assessment of the possible implications. What this work found is that the hazard associated with this new feature in a conservative assessment that we undertook is bound by the shaking levels to which the plant has already been analyzed and found to be safe in the past. And I encourage anyone to look through the document that we've put together. It's very detailed, and we wanted to make it available so that it was very transparent and clear and accessible to the public to understand exactly what actions the NRC took in this regard. We will continue to review all of the data as it comes in, both in terms of the shoreline fault as well as the work that is currently ongoing to better assess the regional tectonics in the area. Some of you may be aware that this new feature was found as a result of an ongoing study to look at the regional tectonics, to look at a reassessment of regional tectonics using the most modern tools as consistent with the licensing basis of Diablo Canyon. And so we take this very, very seriously. We understand the concern of the community, rightly so, and we will continue to look at this information and constantly assess as it comes in.
My name is Liz Appelberg, and I'm with the Mothers for Peace. And my question is, here's what happened. A week ago yesterday, I was on my way to have dinner at Avila, and at 5:30, driving along on Avila Bay Drive, the traffic stopped. And apparently at 4:07 p.m., there was a head-on collision. There was a concert at the golf course there. There were tens of thousands of people. In the summertime, there are thousands of people enjoying Avila Beach. If this had occurred at that time in relationship with an accident at Diablo, there would have been chaos. I'm glad to see people from the county here, and I would like to see something done with the emergency response plan from the county and the NRC, because there was no way to get out of Avila and just this head-on crash without an accident at Diablo. Thank you.
That sounds like a question that may be more suited for someone from the county to answer, because it does involve local emergency evacuation aspects. I understand someone from the county is here now to address that.
Yes, my name is Tracy Vardis. I'm an emergency services coordinator with the San Luis Obispo County Office of Emergency Services. And I am aware of that traffic accident. Any traffic accident around here makes news. But we do actually have plans in place that we would address these types of issues. We know that Avila Beach has one point of ingress and egress, one normal point of ingress and egress is what I'd like to explain. And in addition, we have plans and procedures in place with our Sheriff's Department and with our CHP that in this type of a situation that we would not handle a traffic collision in the normal manner. There would not be the assessment. There would not be the measuring of the lines to determine who's at fault and who wasn't at fault. Those vehicles would be immediately pushed off to the side of the road to allow for egress out of the area. In addition, we have plans in place where we could reroute traffic. It would go through the golf course. Not a perfect world, but it is a plan. And we take them through the community up there in Avila Beach and out through San Luis Bay Drive. In addition, we do have some plans in place. We actually tested them during our annual drill this year, where we work in coordination with Diablo Canyon and with the security forces out there to attempt to evacuate people if there is no release in progress, to evacuate people off the north side of the power plant if we got to the point where we could not use those other available measures.
All right, thank you, Tracy.
Hi, David Weissman, Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility. I'd like to follow up on the seismic. Foot's almost sitting behind me on that. But, well, there we go. Yeah. On the seismic, Mr. Peck wrote back that the U.S. Geological Survey discovered the potential for the fault during a review, and the characterization of the fault is ongoing. However, seismologists with the GS, USGS, NRC, and PG&E determined the potential ground motion would be bound by the Hosgri fault. And he gives an Adams NRC web entry, but that's dated 2007 and 2004, so it couldn't possibly have the 2008 data in it on the Adams file. So Rochelle writes back that she's still interested because how can you characterize the new fault as study being going ongoing, yet make the definitive determination that it's still safe to begin with proceeding of rolling the casks up and down the hill to do that if, as you point out, it's still ongoing? If the characterization is still ongoing and the oversight agencies are calling, our state, on that very morning that they announced it, the state's Assembly Bill 1632, which mandates the California Energy Commission conduct a full cost-risk-benefit analysis of nuclear power, they actually took the wording back in the back room. It had said the state recommends that PG&E conduct seismic reflection, 3D seismic reflection mapping, highest technology studies available. And they went back and instead of recommend, they redlined it right there on the spot and said will conduct these things. So we have that asking for it. Now, that's what we're concerned about is how it can be ongoing but yet pronounced fit and permittable at the same time. Of course, Michael Peck apologizes for any confusion and relates it back to Mr. Drix, who once again says the same thing, that based on the current information, and Rochelle just asking one thing. You indicate NRC seismologists reviewed PG&E's initial findings and agreed. I would like a copy of the NRC review and all the independent backup the commission used to come to its conclusion. That was February 24th. And that's kind of still what she's waiting for, not the eight-page summary, but we have seismologists. We have our assemblyman, Sam Blakesley, Dr. Sam Blakesley, PhD, geology, specialty seismology, who has proposed a bill which requires this reflective mapping. And we'd certainly like to run that information by them. So that's the first thing we'd like to know is when will we get a chance to see the so-called new and independent study of the fault? We have two California legislative bills depending on this. And then the question would be that this is not a new issue. Remember, the Mothers for Peace raised the issue of the seismic at the original hearing for the spent fuel storage. And we're not, it was told that the issue was dismissed, not on its merits, but simply because they were told they would have to reopen the entire seismic relicensing case, which no one had the money for at the time. And speaking of money, in a state that's about to go bankrupt, the question is, why is our legislature, right, white item, is the NRC tracking and trending this rise and flux of retirement, replaced, lost knowledge, institutional memory? Is that being trended, and is there data on that? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Weissman. I counted about 20 questions out of that. But let me start. Probably I can answer the brain drain question. Is, you know, with the demographics of utilities changing, where we monitor performance of the nuclear plants, and one of the things specifically that we look at is human performance, and that is a substantive cross-cutting issue. And anytime there's an issue or finding, we determine significance, but then we also determine why did that finding happen. And that's where we look at the attributes, and one of the attributes could be training, could be knowledge. So we do look at that, and there has been issues in plants where there's been human performance, and there's been a common thread or a trend where the major contributing cause for a problem has been, you know, lack of training or knowledge. So we do look at that, and I know, too, that utilities are looking at that as well, is to ensure that there's a knowledge transfer, to ensure that the brain drain, as you call it, that all the knowledge is not lost. So I hope that helps to address that question there.
Is there a chart that actually somewhere, you know, you can track when this many plants seem to have this many retirees and this many losses? We also notice, say, another line that might indicate, for example, an increase in problem identification failure. In other words, is that being...
No, I don't think there is one that there is any trend that I am personally aware of, but I can look and... There could be one, but I'm just not personally aware of one. And then I can get that to you if I can find it. And then you also had some questions regarding some of the seismic issues and if it's okay to have Annie address those.
Sorry. Thanks. As I mentioned, I'm actually the one that was responsible for the in-house independent analysis of the possible implications of the shoreline fault. As I mentioned, we do have a publicly available document, which is available to anybody who would like to see it, that fully documents all the information that we based our initial assessment on, the analyses we undertook, every parameter that went into that assessment, and that's available. And we know that you've received it because you've commented on it, with a question being an analysis when you don't have all the information in hand. What you do is you basically make conservative assumptions in the areas that there is uncertainty. So in terms of we're not exactly sure where the fault is located and how big it is, we have a plane of epicenters, which gives us enough information to perform an analysis. What we did is we made a very conservative assumption as to the length. We made it took it the length all the way to the Hosgery Fault. We made a conservative assumption with regard to how deep it could be. We looked at a number of parameters that could change its location. We did an analysis to bring it closer to the plant, for example. And as I mentioned, this analysis was performed purely in-house. It was reviewed by approximately 10 NRC seismologists. In terms of the 3D reflection, I'm sorry.
And of that data analysis you just spoke of conducting, yes. How much of the data or the raw input is dated beyond November 18th, 2008? The day that the fault was announced, if I'm not mistaken. In other words, how much of it is you had existing, and how much of it is new information that you're feeding into this model?
It's all new information.
So sometime after November 18th, you went out and conducted new...
No, that was when it was provided to us by the USGS. The information that that we used as the basis for the analysis was information that was obtained by the USGS as a result of the ongoing work under the Collaborative Research and Development Agreement. So the information that we have is essentially the information that they developed, which show that there might be a feature there. And so with that new information that came in, basically an updated analysis of epicenter locations, which indicated that there was a planar feature. So this is all new information. It's not something from past information. As soon as we were notified that there was something there, we were provided basically all of the information that the USGS had produced. We had an opportunity to speak to them about it, and we used that as the basis of the analysis. Again, all of this is documented. It's publicly available. We wanted to make this all very, very transparent, the commitment that PG&E has made to the NRC. In addition, as part of the licensing basis, particularly as described in the commitments made in the long-term seismic program, PG&E has a commitment to, on an ongoing basis, review the seismicity in the region around Diablo Canyon to use the most modern techniques and to constantly work on characterization of the seismicity around Diablo Canyon. I think that the program that was developed as part of the CRADA is an example of their approach to meeting these requirements. We've already seen that we're getting new information from this in terms of this feature. So we fully intend to constantly review the data that we are receiving to make sure that the commitments to the NRC are upheld.
A document where the one you mentioned where PG&E actually said, you said, makes this commitment to pursue the 3D reflection mapping?
In the research information letter, there is a reference to the document. The NRC public site has the number is listed in here. You can go to the NRC site and get it.
Okay.
Good evening. My name is Paula Dalek. I'm a resident of Morro Bay. And I also have a concern about seismic issues. I think it was Mr. Peck on the left end when we started off this evening who was addressing measures to protect safety and in particular the earthen berms to shelter the casks. And I think I heard him say that these berms are not approved for high seismic zones like Diablo. Are there any other measures planned to shelter these casks which will be in this high seismic zone?
That was me that made that comment. But actually, the comment that I mentioned was with respect to the underground underground isthmus, not the berms. What I mentioned was that there is a design for an underground isthmus that is in the NRC's under NRC review, but that design is not applicable to high seismic areas such as defenses with every design feature such as berms, for example. And berms don't provide any added protection that is needed for the cast designs that we've licensed.
Well, on other nuclear power plants that have the casks, do they use the berms?
There are a few that I'm aware of that do. Most do not.
Hello, my name is Linda Seeley with the San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace. I'm wondering about, again, about the isthmus. Casks, as I understand it, that we are going to get are not the most robust cask that is available to be used. And I'm wondering why we don't have the most robust cask.
I may call upon one of my counterparts to answer part of this question, but we do not make evaluations of which casks are most robust. What we do make evaluations of is we do a detailed review, licensing review, and safety evaluation of each cask design to ensure that it meets our standards for safety. So we do not go beyond that point to judge which ones that have met our design for safety are more robust than others.
So then that's a decision that's made by PG&E. It's like a tire. You can buy like a cheap tire or a good tire, and the cheap tire will get you there, but the good tire will protect you better,
The only isthmus that we will license is the good isthmus in that analogy. We don't issue licenses to isthmus that fail to meet our licensing criteria.
Exactly, but... There is an issue called quality, and all of us know it. The quality is something that is measurable, and as I understand it, there is a more robust cask model that could be used. And what my understanding is the PG&E ordered these casks like 4 or 5 years ago or something, and so even though there's something that could protect us as the residents of San Luis Obispo more from the possibility of a lethal radioactive leak at Diablo Canyon, even though there is something.
In different prospects since 1996, I've seen, to my knowledge, every single cast design out there that the NRC has approved, and I do not know of any other cast design that is more robust. I'm not sure where that information is coming from, but I do know that this cast system is one of the most robust systems out there, and I do not know of any issue from safety or otherwise that would cause myself, if I lived here, because I did work at a nuclear plant at one time. I did have an isthmus where I was at. I do not know of anything from these casts that would cause me any concern.
Good evening. I'm Gerald Strickland. I'm a manager at Diablo Canyon, responsible for the used fuel storage program. The storage system that we've employed at Diablo Canyon is, as Mr. Keller noted, a very robust system. And the system is, from my perspective, the best system that's out in the industry at this point in time. There's been discussions as far as other options available for the future, such as an underground storage system. And if an underground storage system is licensed and in turn is qualified for the higher seismic region that Diablo Canyon is in, then that's something that PG&E would be interested in considering. But people in the public at this point in time should understand that PG&E has selected the best system available for our application.
Yes, I'm Joe Morris. I'm a local resident of Morro Bay. I moved here just recently, about 8 months ago, where, before I was a professor of psychology at Cal State University Northridge. So I'm a credentialed psychologist. I have a very different question about safety I wanted to raise with you people today. And my question to you is not so much the physical safety of the plant. We've been reassured today and other times about its physical safety, but it's about its psychological safety. Now, what I mean by that is my concern of somebody, about somebody who is wanting to do some deliberate harm to the nuclear facility. Now, my concern is about the psychological and social consequences of a failed attempt. And even with a failed attempt, it's likely there would be widespread apprehension, panic, not just locally, but around the nation. Now, with the high security needed, it's very difficult or impossible even to know what could be told to people, but it is likely that this impact would be serious on mental health issues, causing such behaviors as absence from work, increased auto accidents, widespread apprehension, certainly great concern and panic if people can't get away, as somebody pointed out with the roads around here. We can only recall the effect on us in California in 2001, being 3,000 miles away from the World Trade Center. At that time, planes were grounded around the nation. It's likely that many other nuclear power plants, I would think, would be closed for a period of time, even with the failed but serious attempt, and this causing widespread economic disruption, which is exactly what we don't need at this time. And we're speaking here of a failed attempt. So my question is, what is being done to handle these possibly widespread mental health needs in terms of law enforcement, counseling available, contacts with local schools, hospitals? There's many unknowns. And this is a real need, just as there's a need for physical safety. I don't see anything in any of the materials here or that I've seen that indicates any expertise or planning about this.
That's a tough question. What I can address is that the NRC and the country itself is much more prepared in today's world, post 9/11, especially from an aircraft threat. There's a lot of barriers that have been put into place. Regarding your question regarding what is being done to, I guess, to address the psychological impact for a fail, I cannot really address that question, per se, of what's been done there. I can possibly take a look for you, but it's probably the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. I don't think we've really done much in that area. But I can look and get back with you. We have somebody here also from the security staff at headquarters that maybe can shed some additional light on that issue. This is Scott Morse from the nuclear...
He's not going to let me hold the microphone. He's afraid I'm going to take it away from him. Actually, I am Scott Morris. I am from NRC headquarters in Rockville, Maryland. I am the deputy director for reactors. Big goals, strategic objectives as an agency is to try to be as maximize public outreach and understanding. And, you know, I mean, to the extent that there are issues, we try to put them in context, in the proper context, safety or security context. I think we do as best we can as an agency to try to assure people that when issues come up, we understand what happened, we're staying on top of the facility to make sure they're addressing the issue and that we're making the public fully aware of what's going on. I mean, I think that probably does go a long way. I hope it goes a long way to providing reassurance and public confidence, not only in the NRC, but in the operation of the facility. So, but it's an interesting question, and I do think, you know, we can certainly
take a look.
I don't think we have the right skill set here in the room to take that on directly, though.
Thank you.
My name is Henrietta Groot. I'm a member of the Mothers for Peace, also the Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility. Couple of questions for you here. First of all, when I prepared for this meeting, I looked at the website, at your notice, to see what the reports were telling us, and I could not figure out whether you had looked in your review at the spent fuel pools. To me, that is the most dangerous part of the whole operation. The pools have been re-racked numerous times. The spent fuel units are much closer together than they were originally intended to be. And I could not tell whether this was looked at all in your inspection or not. So that's my first question. Second question is, we should not only be concerned about the safety of the human species. I have for years been concerned about what we're doing to the marine life in these nuclear power plants that are located on the coast. So is the NRC at all looking at what you can do to safeguard marine life, not just human life, but marine life as well? Thank you.
I'd like to answer the first question that you had about our inspection activities related to spent fuel pools. And we do look at the...
In which the units were much more distant from each other.
There has been some effort that PG&E has taken to put high-density racks, fuel racks, in the spent fuel pool. And those racks have been reviewed and licensed as part of the NRC activities.
In other words, they had to get licenses for the re-racking?
I believe so. I'm not an expert in that field. What we do as inspectors is we review the operation in regard to how that's described in their final safety analysis report, which goes either under a specific license amendment or under a change control process if a license amendment isn't required. Somebody else can speak to the actual licensing requirements for spent fuel pool.
I'm Mike Markley. I'm chief of the plant licensing inspection for Region 4. And what we normally do is if they were changing their racks and increasing density or otherwise, we would look at adequate cooling and criticality controls. So, I mean, for them to change their racks in any substantial way, we review it. It's a license. It's required to be a license amendment. And we do have submittals from other utilities in-house right now where we're looking at spent fuel pool criticality. Scott would be the better person.
Well, the issue of terrorism came up much later in the game. And my question then is, have you looked at how safe the spent fuel pools are from a terrorist attack?
I just want to take that microphone away from
you.
I'm sorry. It's a good question. The question had to do with have we re-reviewed the spent fuel pool as part of the security. I got to turn this thing off. It's going to drive me crazy. Have we looked at the spent fuel pool from a security perspective, given the fact that there's been re-racking to higher density spent fuel? And the answer is the spent fuel pool is part of spent. Said simply, in the security context, we prescribe what adversaries' tactics can come be presented at the plant that have to be defended against with high security program features and from a headquarters licensing review perspective. And then, of course, there are baseline security inspections that occur routinely and force-on-force exercises in which mock adversaries actually try to come in and damage the spent fuel pool. And the licensee has to be able to demonstrate that they can protect against that tactic. So hopefully that answers your question. So it's not really, we don't, in the security realm, don't concern ourselves. I mean, spent fuel is in the pool. Okay, we understand that. Your security program should not allow the adversary to even get there.
I want to grab the mic too. I'm Eric Benner. I'm currently the branch chief of licensing for spent fuel storage and transportation. But my previous job was the chief of the environmental review branch. And what I can tell you is when the plant was initially licensed, we did conduct a thorough environmental review and prepared an environmental impact statement. We called it a final environmental statement at that time, which did look at impacts on marine life. If the applicant chose to renew their license, we would conduct an additional environmental impact statement looking at the environmental impacts on all forms of life, including marine mammals. For certain license amendments, we do environmental assessment, including if the plant wants to do any significant increase in power. But all that just assesses the impacts on the environment. But part of that assessment includes interacting with the state, which imposes permit requirements on temperature discharge of water, intake rates, what kind of protective screens or whatnot need to be put in front of the plant. So at these certain periods in the licensing process, the NRC gets very involved, but the state is continually looking at the impacts on the marine environment to see if those permitting requirements continue to be adequate. So the actual permit requirements, as mandated by the Clean Water Act, are the responsibility of the state.
And so I'm hoping that the NRC will look ahead and plan for the day when somebody says no more.
Well, I think, again, what the NRC has looked at is the relative environmental impacts of once through cooling versus cooling towers. And again, what it comes down to is we're going through this now in several relicensing in the Northeast where the state has considered imposition of conversion to cooling towers. The Oyster Creek facility in New Jersey is one such facility. So certainly if the state decided that from a impact on marine mammal standpoint that open cycle cooling was no longer acceptable and imposed close cycle cooling towers, what the NRC's role in that context would be to ensure that the plant could still operate safely using cooling towers versus once through cooling.
Good evening. My name is Mark Mitchell. I'm the Executive Director of the Engineers and Scientists of California, Local 20 of the International Federation of Professional and Technical Engineers. Our union represents almost 350 nuclear engineers, professionals, planners, and others at Diablo Canyon. And I was here last year when we had the town hall meeting in San Luis Obispo to report that as of April 2nd, 2008, 162 nuclear engineers had just voted 2-1 to join our union. Subsequent to that, a group of 90-plus nuclear professionals voted 2-1 to join our union. I'm sorry to report today, 14 months later, we still don't have an agreement covering any of the rates of pay or working conditions of these important key professionals that keep the plant running efficiently and safely. We don't have any contract to report to you, nor do we have hopes of one. We have unprecedented labor strife at this plant. And tomorrow, in an unprecedented action, dozens of nuclear engineers and professionals are busing to San Francisco to picket Peter Darby's PG&E headquarters at 77 Beale Street in San Francisco. One of your staffers, Mike Markley, commented to me that he didn't know of any other place where the engineers were unionized. This is a unique situation because of a uniquely concerning situation, his plan to eliminate 400 jobs at the plant. When he found out that of the unionized employees, he couldn't eliminate any of these jobs, he eliminated the non-union workforce by 20%, which included 20% of the nuclear engineers that were on staff at that time. The engineers were already short-staffed, and now we have less than 156 of them left at Diablo Canyon. And you can tell that this is insufficient when we look at San Onofre, an analogous type of plant in the same sensitive seismic coastal California environment where over 400 engineers are employed. Management has a relentless perspective for short-term gains, short-term profits, has a perspective of not acting in the long-term responsible interest of the long-term responsible management of the unique and delicate asset that is Diablo Canyon Power Plant. The upper management here lasts a couple years and moves on. An example is Donna Jacobs was here for about a year and moved on to another job. These are not people that come with the long-term interest of the planet heart, but with the interest of filling their pockets, cashing in on short-term turnaround profits. After April 2nd, 2008, when two out of three engineers voted to go union, PG&E adapted a new labor strategy. Mr. Conway hired an outside labor negotiator, not just anyone in the country, not the one from San Onofre plant, but the one that is the outside labor council to the Susquehanna power plant, the nuclear power plant that has been identified by your agency as the one with the worst record, or one of the worst, regarding the willingness of employees to report safety concerns to management. So sadly, this current situation is not accidental. In fact, it's the result of a conscious labor strategy bought and paid for by PG&E management to punish its most recently unionized workers, to dissuade any future efforts to organize, and to weaken and discredit an increasingly powerful and independent ESC Local 20. When we say things are bad, we mean that they're really bad. The final offer to nuclear engineers would have these highly skilled and enormously valuable employees paid less than all other unionized engineers at PG&E, and would also eliminate the senior consulting engineer, senior advising engineer classifications, which, as you all know, are hard-won prestigious job titles that are given to the most highly skilled and well-regarded engineers throughout the company and throughout the field of engineering. Diablo Canyon is the only place PG&E management proposes to eliminate, and that's not sustainable on a personal level or a professional level. Okay, now what are the issues? Management's trying to impose a short-term incentive plan bonus program on the newly unionized engineers and professionals at the plant. It's part of its rabid focus on short-term turnaround profits. The STIP program, bonus program, can be and has been manipulated to inhibit the professional, independent discretion of engineers that are key to the safe operation of the plant. Workforce planning at the plant is non-existent. There hasn't been a successful hire of a new engineer in many, many, I think, 4 years. When we started complaining about this, I've heard that there's been some recent hires, but this is a new development. ERO is mandatory for engineers. Other people that are paid for, that have to be paid for emergency response organization responsibilities are not given that responsibility so that the company can save money. This community deserves emergency responders that are willing to and want to be assigned that responsibility. They shouldn't be dependent on people who are threatened with termination if they don't serve. Okay. 344 out of the 1,400 employees at the plant are managers. That's not sustainable. It doesn't make sense. We need the NRC to look at what's going on at this plant. It's a canary in the coal mine. The unionization is not anything but an indicator of deeper problems. The premier survey that the company did of its own employees, which our members did not answer, two interesting responses, and now with that I'll finish. My work group has the resources necessary to do quality work. 40% of the people in nuclear said yes. That's quite low. And one other response that's concerning. Senior management, i.e. the CEO, senior vice president, shows by its actions that quality is a top priority at PG&E, 45%. These are responses largely from managers, since our union folks didn't answer this survey. Things are not well at the plant, and I hope next year to be able to come and report to you that things have improved. Thank you.
Well, yeah, one of the things that we're not prepared to discuss or talk about are internal management labor issues, you know, but one of the things that I want to leave the members of the community here with is that, you know, we are concerned about the activities that are ongoing at the site. I know Tony and Michael are specifically, they talk to the engineering staff on a day-to-day basis, and they perform constant inspections where they do evaluate the quality, quantity, and the technical rigor of the work that the engineers perform at Diablo Canyon. To date, you know, there have been minor issues that have been identified, but those issues are entered into the corrective action system, and once those issues are identified, they are followed up on and they are corrected. But as far as the
armed, wonder if my property would be of no value after an accident. We've suffered some psychological stress here because of Diablo. I wanted to make that point. I bet none of you have what I have, a Geiger counter in my house to monitor my own activity of Diablo. Back to my point here, the storage of nuclear, well, in the 1970s, the cost of Diablo was estimated at $800 million. The storage of nuclear waste was guaranteed by the government. Now that storage is in our backyard. Now in 2009, the cost of replacing the steam generators is more than $800 million. What will the future costs be? It raises the question, what will happen in the next 30 years or the next 100 years? Can we even think about 1,000 years ahead? No, that's pretty difficult to do. Can we imagine what this area will be like in 10,000 years? No, we really cannot. It's beyond our ability to comprehend. Yet we're planning to leave tons of radioactive waste around for 10,000 years. That is unfathomable, and ludicrous. Worse than that, it's selfish and greedy. We are not living within our means. Why do we continue to push the reconciliation of our lifestyle into the future? Why are we leaving a huge mess for others to deal with? You who are hired to guide us, what kind of stewardship are you proposing for us? Live today, live for today, and the hell with the future. What about choosing, what about closing Diablo until you figure a way to store that waste for 10,000 years? Wouldn't that be logical? Wouldn't that be prudent? What about developing alternative energy with the amount of funding and effort we've put into nuclear power? How about Yucca Mountain, $50 billion in development? Going, going, gone. That money could have put a huge dent in our energy independence. In contrast to Yucca, how about exploring residential solar energy at $15,000 or $20,000 per household with some tax credits? Or low-power motors, better light bulbs, turning off power sources when they're idle? In a world where we fight over oil and spend uncontrollably on nuclear safeguards, we can do better. We know America can rise to a challenge. Let's challenge ourselves, diligence, because you're taking us down a path of seemingly endless headaches and maintenance problems, as displayed by the status of Yucca Mountain and the performance of nuclear power, no new plants in the last 20 years, etc. Thank you.
Thank you for your comment.
My name is Martin Meltz. I'm a retired biomedical research scientist, and I've only lived here for 3 months. I was a radiation biologist. I am a radiation biologist. And I served as a volunteer on the Regional Emergency Medical Preparedness Steering Committee in Bear County, Texas. I want to address the issue of psychological impacts that has been mentioned twice already. What I'm learning is that that may have to be something that comes out of the county emergency response plan, taking advantage of volunteers from the counseling community of this county. So I think it's something to look into. It's not something that can be paid for. But there are resources in the schools. There are private counselors who have to be recruited because this is something that we can't afford to pay for. We're going to need volunteers. And we need volunteers for lots of things. But if we can reduce some of the fears and some of the panics, when mention was made of an accident, I'd be as worried about the accidents that follow the accident in terms of the panic and fear if people really don't have to be in a state of panic and fear based on which way the wind is blowing. So there are all sorts of issues that have to be addressed and can be addressed, and I think we have to reference this back now to the county and see what the county has done or can do.
Tracy Vardis again from the County Office of Emergency Services, and I'm glad you asked this question because I was at a conundrum earlier. It's like, do I get up and say what we're doing? Because it really wasn't asked, so thank you. We actually do have plans in place, and we understand the psychological effects. We work very closely with our mental health department, and they are all part of our emergency response plans and procedures. And in the event that we have any indication that there is a potential incident out at Diablo Canyon, we immediately open and activate what we call congregate care centers, both to the south and to the north of us. And even without a release of radiation, we request that portal monitors are taken up there and that individuals with lead professionals. And as far as volunteers, I am in desperate need for volunteers. I work 50% of my time doing Diablo Canyon emergency preparedness and 50% of my time over at the public health agency working with mental health and with our nurses and staff. And we have something called the Medical Volunteer Program. And I'm in the process of recruiting volunteers from the community that have psychiatric licenses, that are pharmacy techs, that are nurses, that are doctors, that are any type of technicians that we could utilize in an emergency because we don't have enough people for the entire community that may be affected. And actually, we go through the American Red Cross. They do recruitment for us, and I have a training class on June 30th at the American Red Cross at 6 p.m., and I welcome any of you to go ahead and come there. You can email me if you want more information. It's tvardas, V-A-R-D-A-S, at co.slo.ca.us, and we'll be happy to have you.
Thanks, Tracy.
I have, let me start, I'm Peg Pinard, and I am the former supervisor for District 3, which includes Diablo Canyon. And I was also one of the litigants in the initial lawsuit against PG&E and the NRC. Now, I have 2 points I would like to make. One is in response to the issue that was raised about marine life. And the response that was given by you was totally inadequate to say that we abide by state rules. I was at the meeting that the state, PG&E, and the NRC were seated, along with many, many fishermen who were complaining about the lack of larvae and ability for the nearshore fisheries to blossom and provide the kind of ongoing, sustainable environment that we had come to expect because of the increased temperature out at Diablo Canyon. The fishermen at the time had requested that the disbursement of the water be farther offshore so as not to impact the nearshore environment. And the Coastal Commission, our state, did nothing. So the fact that you can quote them and say we abide by the state does not generate much confidence. Now, the other issue that I would like to bring up is many times tonight you've already said that we have tested the ability for safety out at the plant. Initially, and this is especially with regard to the spent fuel pools, initially the NRC said, terrorism, not an issue, not a problem, of no conformance with your license, only means that the licensing has become more and more lax as time has gone on. Those racks are double racked. The
possibly even triple rack by now. I haven't been in on those meetings. But when I met with the NRC, when I was supervisor, they expressed the fear that they were terrified that anything would drop into those pools. Number one, they didn't even have a good idea of what was in the pools. There was material in there that was unaccountable for. Number two, if anything got dropped in those pools, it would compromise the distance that had originally been determined to be safe. Now, here's the rub. You have said here tonight that you have run these tests of safety, and you have found that you can stop somebody who wants to attack or drop something of any matter into the spent fuel pools. But you refuse to have anybody other than yourselves say that. That's what's wrong. Now, we're not asking that you open everything up for televised review. There are people who meet the national security standards for being able to be part of those discussions. Scientists who have the right credentials, the attorney who handled this at the Supreme Court, Diane Curran, has the proper clearances. Now, all we have been asking is that you allow one of these people to sit in on those meetings so that somebody other than yourselves can hear about the safety and what you have planned or have done, because right now nobody else knows it but you, and you're asking us to trust you, who told us the first time that terrorism was not an importance and who dragged your feet every step of the way to try to act on behalf of the people instead of on behalf of PG&E. Thank you.
I would like to make a comment. Made a statement that terrorism was not important, made it sound that there was no security prior to 9/11, that there was security around the nuclear power plants prior to 9/11, and that we did look as well as from a security perspective to be able to make sure that if there was any terrorism attacks or something, that there was adequate defenses prior to 9/11. Thank you.
My name is Tim Klein. I'm the site representative for SEIU, Local 24/7. We represent the security officers at Diablo Canyon. And I'd just like...
Mr. Becker, you wanted to respond to that? Thanks. I'd like to respond to some of the comments that Mr. Mitchell made a few speakers ago. First of all, and most importantly, are the engineers, the quality inspectors, and the other classifications that have organized under ESC, as he described, they have done and continue to do a great job at Diablo Canyon, and that's really the most important point I wanted to make right there. I constantly compliment our workforce, including the workforce I'm referring to here, on their talent and dedication, and that continues to this day, and it is the reason Diablo Canyon has been a successful plant. So that is fully recognized. Secondly, I think it's equally as important to point out that we most emphatically do take a long-term view with the operation of Diablo Canyon. The fact that we have been a successful plant for this many years is one piece of evidence of that. The other piece of evidence is standing in front of you. I am the site vice president. This is my 27th year as a PG&E employee, so I have taken the long-term view and continue to take the long-term view for the success of the plant. Some of the statements that were made, I'm not going to go through every one of them, but I'll just leave it that there were some inaccuracies in some of the statements that Mr. Mitchell did make. One of them was that Mr. Conway never made a statement that we were intending to reduce by anywhere near 400 people. That was never put out to the workforce. That somehow did come out in a newspaper article. It was a misquote. It was never our intent. And in fact, the record shows it was never our intent to do anything even approaching that. Thank you.
My name is Hugh Wadman. I'm a resident of San Luis Obispo itself. I retired here about 12 years ago. My background is I first came to this country in 1951 and was working with radioactive materials in research at the University of Berkeley, California on postgraduate research, postdoctoral research. I've been interested in the use of radiation for medical, scientific background purposes. Ever since I joined the Sierra Club in 1953, I am now a 20-year lifetime member, but I emphasize I am not a spokesman for the Sierra Club, since I am in sharp disagreement with their policies with respect to nuclear energy today. I think they're ill-founded. My concern I wish to raise to you is the concerns of wider use of nuclear power. It's obvious that as the process is conducted at the moment, in which the spent fuel is set aside in spent fuel pools and in concrete casks, one can, I suppose, conceive of some incredible method of extracting the plutonium from it. But it's, of course, there are perfectly straightforward methods of avoiding this occurring, and I'm concerned the extent to which the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is concerned with implementing those wider measures of preventing the availability of plutonium to terrorist nations and to terrorists in this country, et cetera, et cetera. I'm particularly concerned with the fact that, of course, not all plutonium is created equal, that only plutonium-239 is available, is appropriate for weaponry purposes, and that the plutonium-240 is not any valid use for weaponry. It's essentially non-weaponizable. The issue is that with higher levels of enrichment of the fuels entering the reactors, they can run to a higher burn-up, and this results in the exiting fuel having a lower utility for weaponry purposes. In addition, if one goes to appropriate recycling, Purex methods, etc., then the fuel that is the transuranics and plutonium that is recycled further builds up the 240 in the fuel, and if with implementation of what is the obvious scientific route, then the issue of diversion of plutonium to weaponry purposes is a moot and dead issue. There is no potential for making a weaponry out of it. I'm raising a technical question, but it seems to me that we hear localized responses, localized concerns for stealing something from the spent fuel pools or the concrete casks. I cannot even remotely imagine how you could do that. I certainly don't want to be part of it. It would be a very dangerous operation, and I don't think one could get one's hands on it, frankly. Now, my concern is much more for the longer-term issues, and my concern, so addressing you as you folks, is to what extent is the NRC concerned with, available for moving the energy policies of this country to a better scientific basis, which would clearly involve reprocessing, use of MOX fuels, getting away from the once-through cycle, and hence, of course, avoiding very low.
What you're saying, I think, is I'm total technical agreement with you. We as a regulatory agency don't promote reprocessing. We don't promote building additional plants or not building plants. Our goal is to ensure that if a political decision is made to pursue a particular option, fuel reprocessing is one, that it's done safely, it's done within the context of a proper detailed licensing perspective, to ensure that our agency goals for public safety and health are met. So to answer your question, you make some very good technical arguments, but we're not in that business of either promoting or not promoting a particular application of nuclear energy and nuclear technology.
Can I extend very briefly, how do I persuade my politicians to implement your charge, your charter, to the point where you can do what is obviously necessary in the future?
Well, I think DOE is probably the appropriate place to start that campaign.
Oh, we're getting another mic? Okay, all right.
just waiting for a mic. One of these mics, if you could, and then whoever has the questions, come up here so that we don't use the valuable time. So the next person who would want to ask a question, if they don't mind coming up here.
Right.
I think you can disconnect it. There you go. Thank you.
I don't think you're going to be able to go too far with that.
Testing, 1, 2, 3, it works.
It's like a game show.
Learned a lot from it, so I can say nice things about the NRC, and I just did, and that's the end of them. Anyway.
Yeah. I thought there'd be more.
So, thanking you for today's meetings, however, there does remain a fundamental barrier to public confidence in the NRC, at least in the eyes of the Mothers for Peace and our supporters. And I believe it originates in the word adequate. If you notice the second and third slides up there, they showed in writing the mission of the NRC, which is to provide adequate security and adequate safety. And Mothers for Peace has a slightly higher standard than adequate, and therein lies all the problems. As the NRC staff knows, Mothers for Peace legal challenge does not seek to stop the use of dry casks at Diablo, but it does intend to force the NRC to order the maximum, not adequate, maximum protection of those casks from terrorist attack. All of us who live here, we pay for the NRC as taxpayers. We fund Diablo as ratepayers. And in addition, the Mothers for Peace and our supporters, every 4, 5, or 6 years, we have to raise between $80,000 and $100,000 to pursue a case in federal court. So I feel as if we as citizens, and we're a small local group, we're taking the responsibility that the NRC is not taking to provide more than adequate protection for safety and security, not only for those of us who live here now, but as one speaker said, the marine life, and other people mentioned future generations, a lot of future generations, because the end point of this radioactive waste from Diablo Canyon is at Diablo Canyon next to an active major earthquake fault. It's not going anywhere else. It's staying here. And that's why we're so concerned. I started by thanking you for this format, and I think you provided this more open communication, two-way communication, so thank you for the experts that came also. So I think you did this to boost public confidence in the regulatory process, and while that intention is highly appreciated, it's not being fulfilled yet. Public confidence will soar when the NRC raises its...
Hi, good evening. My name is Jack McCurdy. I'm co-founder and co-president of the Coastal Alliance on Plan Expansion, otherwise known as CAPE, a nonprofit citizens group in Morro Bay that for 10 years has been fighting to make sure that if a new power plant, new gas-fired power plant is built in Morro Bay, that it adequately protects public health and the national estuary there. A couple of years ago, the California Energy Commission staff became concerned that there is a cumulative effects between the Morro Bay, would be the new Morro Bay plant, the old one. It's only running about 6% of the time now. And the Diablo plant, of course, which has extremely severe impacts on the marine resources. It was going to conduct a study about these cumulative impacts, and by cumulative impacts, I mean that the ocean area that the two plants draw from overlap, and therefore they're more severe, according to the staff. Just recently, the staff dropped plans for that study because the State Water Resources Board has draft regulations that will require gas-fired power plants to convert to best technology available in 2015,
and nuclear plants in 2017. So we're left without any information about that. But the State Water Board, which is drafting these regulations and is the prevailing authority in this, will not have that information before them. And we know for sure that all the power plants along the coast, 19 of them, are vehemently opposing these deadlines to impose best technology available, which will amazingly remove a tremendous impact on the environment. But if we have that information, might be a major factor in the state board's will to go ahead with these deadlines, imposing these deadlines. So my question is to you, are you aware of this issue? And secondly, now that you're aware of this issue, would you consider investigating it and requiring a PG&E to conduct authorize independent studies to once and for all establish between the Diablo plant and the Morro Bay plant, which are less so now because the plant's only operating 6% of the time. But if a new plant were built, it would be severe. Well, according to the Energy Commission staff, they're concerned it would be extremely severe. So the question is, we're lacking very crucial information about the impacts of these two plants that the State Water Board needs to have before it to determine whether these deadlines for best technology available are going to be imposed. In fact, to put it bluntly, if this information were known, and it was shown that these cumulative impacts are even more severe than the already severe impacts, it would severely undermine PG&E's opposition to that 2017 deadline.
So what I would, on this issue, I guess, is if there was another plant built, would the impact of Diablo Canyon be taken in consideration with this new plant and the environmental impact? Is that the question? And I would think that that would be considered if there was a new nuclear plant from an NRC's review of the issue, but then also I believe the state would also take a look at the joint environmental impact of an additional unit. Does that address your question?
Well, my understanding is one of your responsibilities is to control or regulate or watch for the environmental impacts of the plants that you regulate. Is that correct?
Right, and that'd be Diablo Canyon, which
then
we regulate.
This is in your purview.
But not another, the non-fossil plant would not be in our purview, from my understanding.
Yeah, yeah. One of the things that we are required to do is that if there is a new nuclear power plant, we are required by the regulations to do an environmental impact statement, and that would assess the impact of the new power plant and what impact it might have on the environment. But if there is a separate fossil plant, coal-fired plant, that's kind of outside the purview of the NRC's regulations. But I think Eric Benner may have a...
I mentioned a plant, Oyster Creek, where we looked at the cumulative impacts from the other drains on the fishery and came to a conclusion of that there were some significant cumulative impacts. We wouldn't undertake an environmental review just because there was a facility outside of the NRC's purview impacting the environment in that area. So just the planned construction of a fossil plant would not cause us to do an environmental review. So it has to be something changing at the nuclear power plant or an initial licensing of a nuclear power plant to cause us to do that detailed environmental review.
Yeah, we have time for a couple of more questions.
Schmidt, and I was just wanting to address the problem of the stored fuel, spent fuel containment or non-containment, and I was just curious on the board's reaction to why this is the unarmored storage of the spent fuel is allowed to be in existence, and your, whether it's your ineptitude or collusion with the power plant and or with this facility, that you cannot address the protection of this. I was at a tour of the plant with a Dr. Rosen who was on their safety or on the review board, and he was unaware of an incident that happened over a decade ago with a commercial airlines that plunged vertically from an insane individual that took it down within 15 miles of the plant. And he was telling me, well, we have major protection from the plant from the containment structures in front to the west or whatever direction and from the silhouette of the mountains behind. This is ludicrous and inept observation, and I find that the most contaminated part and the most susceptible part of this plant being this storage, spent fuel storage plants, and then with our new facility, our storage to be in this unarmored area that I have seen at the plant, and there is, you know, I would enjoy your honest response to my question here, please.
But the spent fuel storage is my understanding here, Diablo, below grade. So it is, and the fuel is in a protected, it is in a protected state. It would take quite a lot to be able
if
to.
If you had an aircraft coming straight, pardon me, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. But if you had this approach, and he was always telling me, well, it's always in this horizontal attack position, but it from today's position, it would be obviously from, and it was shown by this insane individual taking over an aircraft and plunging it from 20,000 feet directly into the ground within 15 miles of Diablo Canyon. And how would you protect us from this type of address of attacking the plant without the guys with the guns and everything and such?
Want to take that?
Yeah, appreciate the question. Again, my name is Scott Morris from Deputy Director for Reactor Security and Headquarters. And a couple things I wanted to address here. I think your question really is about aircraft threat. Is that correct? Is your focus is really the vector that you're worried about is aircraft impact on the spent fuel pool itself?
Correct.
Casks. Okay, I thought you were talking
spent fuel pool.
All of those are obviously.
Let me talk about the pool first. Okay, the pool is below grade. The NRC, first and foremost, let me talk about the threat vector itself. The aircraft threat vector is a characteristic that is not included in our design basis threat. And I don't want to, you know, bore you with what all that means. But essentially, what it means is. In terms of how we derive that. But I will tell you that the aircraft threat, while we don't require the licensee facilities to protect against that threat, we do, in fact, require that there be mitigation measures in place in the event that that very unlikely event would occur. And the reason I'm confident in saying the word very unlikely is we have actually done deep. What I'm telling you is, A, the licensees themselves are not, this is a policy decision made by the NRC commissioners themselves.
What's the policy?
The policy is that the aircraft threat is not part of that which the licensees that we regulate have to protect against actively.
Who regulates that then?
Who regulates what?
The policy to not consider aircraft to be.
The NRC defines a set of adversary characteristics, okay, that the private enterprises like P PG&E have to protect against with high assurance. What I'm telling you is, as a policy decision, our commission determined that the aircraft... No, that's not what I'm saying at all. What I'm saying is that the licensee, we don't require our licensees to have to actively be able to protect against an incoming aircraft threat. What I'm saying is that the federal government as a whole, including all the measures that have been incorporated by FAA, TSA, NORAD, any number of agencies and entities within the government, and the measures that have been
imposed. No fly zone.
There is not a no fly zone. No, there is not.
Okay.
No, there is not.
Okay. No, but.
Well, okay. Let me. There's a lot of issues here, and they're good issues. But what I'm telling you, let me focus on the facility itself. In spite of that point, what I'm saying is some very severe attack vectors were considered on these facilities, including every single spent fuel pool in the country. And I'm telling you that in large measure because of the energy that's resident within those spent fuel elements themselves being relatively low, given when you consider the active core that's in the containment, when you consider a below-grade pool with 23 and a half feet of water over top of it, and all the interfering things that are in place, it's very difficult. It's very difficult to result. We've actually done hitability analyses, putting professional pilots behind jet airliner simulators and asked them to try to hit the targets the size of spent fuel pools. We've asked them to do that in the simulator. We've asked them to do it. And in fact, I think we have a document out in the... it's our information digest, which shows the profiles that we've imposed by order that we've inspected, and I'm getting the hook here, but that would, even in the very unlikely event that it would, A, be hit, and B, that there would actually be a severe radiological release as a consequence, we nonetheless require extensive mitigation measures that be in place. And we have inspected all of those and continue to do so. And we also work with our federal agencies to make sure that the security measures that are in place for the...
In the essence of time, I suggest you guys meet after the meeting to finish this discussion. So I promise one more question, if that's okay. Or,
we're done.
Okay.
Yeah. We one more.
I'm Jill Zalmick with the Mothers for Peace. I have one comment and one question. Blair Spitzberg referenced a thorough analysis on the environmental effects of the dry cask storage facility. In fact, this thorough analysis was barely 8 pages long and hardly thorough, which is why the Mothers for Peace has been forced to return to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals at $100,000. My question is, the first cask is about to be loaded, and I'm feeling some trepidation about it. And one of my many concerns is that I understand that there are high voltage lines above the cement slab where they're being placed. And I also understand that a few months ago was a crane incident involving a meteorological tower and the operator. There was some judgment error from the operator. And I'm just so curious, with the hundreds of acres there surrounding the plant, why the cement slab was placed under the high voltage lines.
Let me ask Ray, are you familiar with the crane incident that she speaks of? Could I ask Ray to speak to that question, and then we also have the project manager for the ISSC license, and Shana, you may want to also respond to the question concerning the analysis that was performed of the high-tension wires.
My name is Ray Keller again. I'm the lead ISSC inspector, and I'm not familiar with the incident that was mentioned relative to the sits on bedrock. That's one of the requirements relative to a high seismic zone, is to make sure that it's adequately founded from a seismic perspective. relative to the transmission towers and transmission lines, I know that LICE-Z as well as the NRC has reviewed the analysis relative to an accident that would be associated with the transmission towers or the transmission lines, and there's no impact to the CASC relative to that. Did that answer the question?
Gerald, do you want to speak to that a little bit?
Sure. The only other point that I would add is that when you look at the types of strata of rock within the coastal regions, that it really varies. And as part of our siting criteria for identifying where a facility would be located, we wanted to site the facility on the same type of rock that the power plant itself is sited on. That way we had a good historical basis of what the seismic hazard would be for being able to design this facility. Then for the 500 kV line system that is directly above the facility, as part of the licensing and design base of the facility, we took conservative assumptions that you would postulate either having a 500 kV line break loose, fully energized, and impact the storage facility and a storage cask, and be able to show that the discharge of the power from that power line would not substantially impact the qualification of that storage cask. So we've gone through a very detailed evaluation to be able to show that there is no consequences. We've also looked at what happens if a tower collapses into the facility to show that there's not an issue with the qualification of the storage facility or the storage casks themselves. We even go beyond what you typically see for design bases in California, and we consider tornadoes that are the same rating that you see in other parts of the Midwest, and looked at what happens if you take one of these transmission towers and pull it apart with a tornado and use the projectiles to throw them into this storage cask. So they're very well designed, very well evaluated.
Thanks.
All right, that concludes the question and answer portion of our meeting tonight. I'd like to turn it over to Chuck Casto, who's going to provide some closing comments.
Wow. Thank you very much for being here. I'm thoroughly impressed the dedication of this group and the knowledge. And I learned a lot, too. I learned a tremendous amount. This is an incredibly informed crowd, group interested from the electricity. So you're paying both. So we're a fee-based agency. We're not on the budget. So we charge the licensee by the hour. There's a base fee that we charge them, plus we charge them by the hour. It's pretty significant that they pay for us. What? So we charge them for the work that we do, all the work that we do. So I just wanted to clarify that. Thank you. You know, we're a unique. There's a base fee that has to be paid, and our full budget has to be paid. And we've increased the size of our agency from about over the last 4 or 5 years from 2,400 to 3,800 people. And, you know, we have an awesome responsibility. We're unique in the federal government. We have the sole responsibility for regulation and oversight of nuclear power plants. You'll find in a lot of different industries that there's many different federal agencies that are responsible for things, but we know we're the ones responsible. We're one agency responsible for the regulation and oversight of nuclear power plants. And each of the 3,800 members of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission understand that, and it weighs heavily on us. And we know we have to come out here and face the public, and you make us better for the questions that you ask and the challenges that you do. You make us better. You make us a better agency for that, and we appreciate the dedication and the quality of questions and being here tonight is evidenced by the late hour. So thank you very much, and be safe going home. Thank you.